My name is Bob Goodkind. I'm a partner in Pryor Cashman, and it's my pleasure on behalf of all our firm to welcome the Middle East Forum to this wonderful occasion. As you all know, the forum's purpose is to define and promote American interests in the Middle East and to help America actually in its own defense. We could not ask for a more appropriate, more brilliant speaker than we have today in Melanie Phillips. As most of you know, and I think you know it, that's why you're here, she's been one of Western civilization's leading analysts and sociologists and historians on the whole subject of the fight of Islamist fundamentalism against Western civilization. I'm not going to go through her extensive biography, except to indicate to you that she initially started her journalism career at The Guardian in 1977 as a correspondent on social policy and social services, and she rose to become the editor of that paper in 1984, and it was at that time that she launched her own opinion column. She is presently writing, I guess, for the Daily Mail. Am I correct in that? Melanie has won a number of awards, but it's important to, I think, note with a smile on her face that she earned the Orwell Prize for Journalism in 1996, and this is the smile. The Islamic Human Rights Commission named her the most Islamophobic media personality of the year in 2003. Her most recent book, and the subject of today's discussion, is The World Turned Upside Down, The Global Battle Over God, Truth, and Power. I don't think I need to say any more. I'm going to turn the podium over to you, Melanie, and we'll have questions and answers, of course. I'll ask each of you to please turn off your cell phones and other electronic devices and enjoy the rest of the program. Melanie?
Thank you very much indeed, Bob, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for having me. It's a very great pleasure to be here and to be back in New York. I was watching all the myriad police officers outside for the reasons that we know, and I felt quite at home. So thank you for making me feel so much at home. As you probably know, in recent years I've been writing about militant Islam, or Islamism, as I would call it. And my previous book, Londonistan, was all about how Britain was failing properly to analyze and deal with the threat posed by the Islamic Jihad. Now, when I considered the threat from the Islamic Jihad and the phenomenon of current-day Islamism, present-day Islamism, one of the very curious things was this. Much of Islamist discourse is impossible to engage with because it turns rationality and logic inside out, as you may have noticed yourselves. So, for example, aggression by radical Muslims in this discourse is always represented as, on the opposite, an attack on Muslims. Israel's attempts to defend itself against Islamic attack is represented completely in a contrary fashion as Israeli aggression. The West has even been threatened with violence on these surreal grounds that it was suggesting that Islam was a religion of violence, and it was effectively saying, therefore, if you say once again that Islam is a religion of violence, I'll kill you. Now, the very strange thing that seemed to me was the case was that despite the fact that this kind of inversion of rationality and logic made dialogue totally impossible, people in the West, particularly in Britain, but elsewhere in the West, were refusing to point this strange dislocation of reason out. They were refusing to point out that they couldn't engage in a dialogue which completely suspended the normal rules of logic and rationality. Instead, they just went along with it. as if it was to be taken entirely seriously. And even more than that, in Britain in particular, but also elsewhere in the West, the Islamic narrative on Israel and the Middle East was adopted by the people who are the custodians of reason, by the intelligentsia, a narrative of the Middle East which turns right and wrong, truth and lies, victim and victimizer, completely on its head, as you may know. So it intrigued me and puzzled and concerned me why the West had done nothing to challenge this total suspension of truth and logic by our Islamist antagonists, by stating that it was such a suspension of truth and logic and putting forward the true situation instead. Now, partly this is for the reasons that I'm sure you know and I've outlined in my previous book, reasons such as fear, cravenness, cowardice, the paralysis of political correctness and minority rights doctrine, which says that minorities can never be criticized. And I've written about all that extensively, but I came to realize that was only part of the story, that the cultural relativism and multiculturalism that I've been writing about didn't just create this paralysis of thought in and of themselves. Those phenomena, multiculturalism, moral relativism, cultural relativism, the doctrines that say there is no such thing as objective truth, no society can say its values are superior to any others, all those sorts of things, they were in turn part of a much broader phenomenon, which was a repudiation of reason across the board. And that is what I've written about in my new book. Because I realized that a very wide range of trends and issues that I was writing about fairly routinely as a journalist had something in common. These trends and issues included moral and cultural relativism, education decline, family breakdown, multiculturalism, all those sorts of issues, plus issues which appear to have, at first blush, nothing in common at all, such as man-made global warming, scientism, or the doctrine that science alone can explain every single thing that is in the universe, the war in Iraq, Israel and the Middle East, and Islamism. Now, all these things I came to realize are based on ideologies, and all involve a repudiation of reason. And this is because the essence of an ideology is that it wrenches evidence, it wrenches reality to fit a prior idea. It does not go where the evidence leads. It does not look at things as they are and say, this is how they are. It says, this is how I think they are because this is how it fits in with my prior idea, my ideology. So it's actually, an ideology is actually inimical to reason and sacrifices also truth to power, if I can put it that way, because it forces the evidence to fit the idea and it forces people, therefore, who uphold truth and reality, it forces them to correspond with the ideology. And if they don't, then they become ostracized and find that they fall foul of the ideologues. So let me give you a couple of examples of what I'm talking about. First of all, man-made global warming. Well, it may come as something of a shock to some of you to hear this, but there is actually very little, if anything, to support the idea that something out of the ordinary, historically unprecedented, is happening to our climate. To give you a couple of sort of bullet points, the climate globally was warmer thousands of years ago. The link between carbon dioxide and the climate is far from straightforward. The seas are not rising, the ice is not shrinking, the polar bears are not vanishing, and Al Gore did not deserve his Nobel Peace Prize. There's been no significant warming since 1995, and temperatures haven't increased at all since 1998, and yet we're told that if carbon dioxide goes up, which it has been, warming must follow. In particular, and in general, I would say, the idea that the climate, which is the most complex system that there is, can be predicted at all, or that its course can be altered by changing just one small factor involved in it, is absurd. Let's look at the war in Iraq. There is every reason for having a debate about the war in Iraq. Was it the right way to deal with Saddam or not? It's an entirely legitimate debate to have had. But in Britain in particular, and in parts of your intelligentsia here, the idea that it was the wrong course to take stopped being an entirely legitimate conflict of views and gave rise to a wholesale denial of evidence and reason. I'll give you one brief example of the denial of reason, the argument that because no weapons of mass destruction were found in Iraq, therefore there had never been any. I mean, as a non-sequitur, this could scarcely be bettered, and it also ignored the evidence of a lot of activity in Iraq under Saddam right to the start of the war in perpetrating or continuing to develop WMD programs. Look at Israel. As I've said already, history there is being turned on its head. Facts and falsehoods, victims and victimizers are reversed. A fictional narrative is now widely accepted, particularly in Britain, as incontrovertible truth. This narrative in Britain, which is a generally accepted thing now, is that Israel was created as a result of Western European guilt over the Holocaust, which uprooted a whole load of European Jews who had no connection to the land of Palestine whatsoever, plunked them in the middle of this land of Palestine, which was the natural home, the indigenous homeland of Palestinian Muslims since time immemorial, from where they drove them out into the West Bank and Gaza, where they are continuing to oppress them. Now, that is generally accepted as true, whereas, as you may know, every single aspect of that is false. Let's look at scientism, this idea, this doctrine that science can deal with every aspect of existence. This is put forward by the people who say that they are the acme of reason. People like Professor Richard Dawkins, for example, whose book, The God Delusion, which basically says that any religious believer is either an imbecile or insane, was a global bestseller. And yet people who propose this theory, that science alone can explain everything in our existence, put forward a number of extremely absurd propositions, such as the claim that life in general, all matter, formed spontaneously out of inanimate matter, or that the theory of multiverses, many universes, for which there is no scrap of evidence. And my particular favourite, which was said to me, to my face, by Professor Dawkins, that the origins of life on Earth, the most plausible explanation for the origins of life on Earth, may have been that life on Earth was seeded by beings from another planet. Now, you may ask how people of reason can arrive at such completely irrational points of view. Now, before I really get to the bottom of that, I want to put another set of ideas before you. The essence of all these apparently disparate ideologies I've been running through, which seem to be so very different from each other, is that they all involve propositions that are not to be debated in a rational way. They are propositions to be regarded as self-evident truths which have the infallibility of religious dogma. Now, this is very odd because they are all of them militantly secular ideologies. And yet, they all share characteristics of religious belief, such as dogmatism, intolerance of dissent, and evangelical fervour. Even more odd, these secular ideologies all display specifically Christian motifs of sin, guilt, and redemption. And even odder still, they all display features of the millenarian, apocalyptic beliefs of the people in the Middle Ages associated with medieval Christianity, the belief that mankind is about to arrive at a state of perfection, that life on earth is about to become utopia through the redemption of sin, the collective redemption of sin. Now, these contemporary secular ideologies I've been going through, sin, guilt, and redemption is their motif. They identify the sins committed by humanity, such as the oppression of third world peoples, the despoliation of nature, bigotry, poverty, war, and they offer redemption and salvation by a return to the path of righteousness. Thus, the Greens believe they will save the planet if we all stop flying in aeroplanes. The leftists believe they will create the brotherhood of man. The anti-Zionists believe they will turn suicide bomb belts into cucumber frames. The atheists believe they will create the garden of reason. And the Islamists believe they will create the kingdom of God on earth. And because they all aspire to create a perfect world, they believe that their creed is synonymous with virtue. It's not simply an argument to be debated. It is virtue. It is the perfection of the world. Who can argue against that? The only people who can argue against that, the only dissenters, therefore, are basically evil. And so dissenters cannot exist. They become the enemies of humanity. And for the Greens, these enemies of humanity are Western capitalists. For the militant atheists, the enemies of humanity are religious believers. And for the left, the enemies of humanity are America and Israel. All these enemies of humanity, in quotes, are getting in the way of perfection on earth. Now, all these enemies of humanity, of whom I hope everyone in this room is one, are essentially contemporary heretics forming, in the eyes of the ideologues, in the eyes of the believers, the true believers in these ideologies, these are contemporary heretics forming diabolical conspiracies against the one revealed truth. So, the decision to invade Iraq, Israel's military operations, skepticism of man-made global warming, or the persistence of religious faith can't possibly have any basis in reason because they deny the truths which cannot be denied of anti-imperialism, environmentalism, and scientific materialism, this belief that everything in the universe has a materialist explanation. And so the only explanation for these dissenters, for the presence of any dissent from these received truths, must therefore lie in terrible conspiracies. Conspiracies by the neocons, conspiracies by the Jews, conspiracies by big oil, conspiracies by creationists. There can't possibly be any rational reason for believing that dissenters are motivated by reason and reality. They must be conspiracies of bad people whose hidden hands are detected everywhere. Now, all these ideologies are aspirations towards secular utopias, perfect societies. And we know that whenever utopias fail, or are seen to fail, because all utopias fail by definition, the people who promote them turn upon people they use as scapegoats in anger and shame. And so just like the medieval millenarians who turned on dissenters, heretics, in the Middle Ages, these modern millenarians persecute dissenters from their own secular faith. So, academics teaching that there are evidence problems with evolutionary theory are fired. Scientists expressing skepticism of man-made global warming theory find they can't get grant funding. Defenders of national identity and traditional morality are vilified as racists, homophobes, Islamophobes, or xenophobes. And Jews protesting at the lies and libels being used to delegitimize Israel are denounced for dual loyalty, demonized as part of a global conspiracy to harm the world, and ostracized socially and professionally. Each of these ideologies manipulates, twists, and distorts evidence to prove its governing idea, which is presented as true, which cannot tolerate any challenge to itself, and must be upheld at all costs. So all challenges must be met by through coercive means, and thus reason is replaced by bullying, intimidation, and the suppression of debate. Now, all this has a most extraordinary similarity to contemporary Islamism, the attempt to impose militant Islam on the non-Islamic world. As I've noted before, Muslim discourse inverts aggressor and victim, freedom and tyranny, truth and lies, in this kind of mad discourse. Moreover, while bad behavior by Muslims is denied, that very behavior is imputed to its victims in a kind of psychological projection of forbidden characteristics, which is a staple of Islamic discourse. What they do, which is bad, is good, and instead the bad is imputed to their victims. So, Islamists declare war upon the West, but then accuse the West of trying to destroy the Islamic world. Some Muslims declare they will have nothing to do with unbelievers, but then the infidel world is accused of Islamophobia if it objects to Muslim prejudice or hostility. Israel is par excellence the target of frenzied psychological projection. So, Islamic countries such as Saudi Arabia, Jordan, or the putative state of Palestine refuse to have Jews living within their borders, yet it's Israel which is falsely accused of ethnic cleansing and apartheid. The Muslim world tells lies about the Jews, but it's Jews who are accused of telling lies about Islam. Nazi-style anti-Semitism pours daily out of the Muslim world, yet that world accuses Zionism of being racist. Iran threatens to wipe Israel off the map, yet Israel is accused of genocide against the Palestinians, whose numbers have actually increased. Now, what is the reason for this extraordinary inversion of truth and lies in Islam? Well, broadly, Islam represents itself as perfection. Everything other than the will of Allah is false by definition. Therefore, true Muslims can do no wrong because they represent perfection. Hence, when they commit mass murder in the name of God, it must be their victims who are the aggressors and the Islamic real aggressors who are the righteous in defending God's law. Since Islam holds that submission to God means freedom, the democratic systems that actually promote freedom are considered a form of subjugation. So language and meaning are turned inside out. Things such as equality, freedom, and justice are defined strictly on the basis of submission to Allah. Therefore, they embody the precise opposite of equality, freedom, and justice as we understand these things to be. That is why, for the Islamists, freedom can only exist in a theocracy where there is no freedom. Defense becomes attack, freedom becomes servitude, peace becomes war, and vice versa. That's why the claim that the jihad against the West is not aggressive or threatening to life and liberty, but is rather a way of delivering freedom to the West, for which we should all be grateful. Now, how can they think like this? Well, as I have learned, Islam's view of knowledge and reason are very different to our view of knowledge and reason. And it's a theological difference. Rather than being, as we believe, reason to be something, knowledge, that is something that we discover for ourselves about the world, knowledge in Islam belongs to God alone. And so all that human beings can do is work out what that divine knowledge is. And so while there have always been Islamic thinkers who have desperately tried to reconcile their religion with reason, this is actually very difficult. Ali Alawi, a former minister in the Iraqi cabinet and now a fellow of Princeton University, and is an Iraqi politician, has written that Islam conceived of three forms of knowledge. The first relied on the Quran and religious texts. The second was mystical knowledge from esoteric branches of Islam, such as Sufism and Shiism. And the third derived from the observation and empirical evidence that they found in the West. Now, according to a particular Islamic scholar, says Alawi, this last form, which is Western-type reason, only developed in Western Islam based in Spain and the Maghreb, a tradition that was attacked and died out. So Islamic thought instead revolved inside knowledge systems that were fixed. In Islamic eyes, therefore, Western science, based on questioning and doubt, merely splits the world. So Western science and reason is actually an intellectual invasion of the Islamic world. And therefore the real Western imperialism is actually no less than Western reason itself. Now the irony is that in this current age where we are under attack from this doctrine of militant Islamism, we in the West are increasingly turning away ourselves from reason towards ideology in the way that I briefly described hitherto. But there's an even more intriguing similarity between the West's retreat from reason and the Islamists' unreasonable attack upon the West. There's an intriguing similarity. To many in the West, Israel's behavior and even its very existence are the root cause of the Islamic Jihad. The reality is the other way around. It's Muslim hatred of Jews which is the root cause of the war in Israel between Jews and Arabs. Islamists make no bones about the fact that what motivates them above all is their hatred not just of Israel but of the Jews. In 1998, Osama bin Laden said, the enmity between us and the Jews goes back far in time and is deep-rooted. There is no question that war between us is inevitable. The hour of resurrection shall not come before Muslims fight Jews. And there are many other similar references. Now, the thing is this, while Islam, as we know, wants to convert or destroy all unbelievers, and while the treatment of Christians and Jews differs from others as the peoples of the book, under Islam. It is nevertheless the Jews who attract within Islam, within Orthodox religious Islam, the most intense expressions of hatred. It's true that the Quran contains certain warm words towards Jews, but these are in a period of time which is deemed by the religion to have been abrogated by later developments which are much more militant against Jews. And that was when Muhammad went to war against the Jews because they refused to accept his reinterpretation of Judaism. And that's the heart of the problem. It's not simply an enmity against Jews as a kind of territorial expansionist thing. Very specifically, what was the fight with the Jews about? It was because Muhammad said, I am reinterpreting Judaism, and you Jews have to accept my reinterpretation. And the Jews said no, and they were slaughtered. And that is the essence of the fight. It's about Judaism and who has the legitimate claim to what Judaism actually is, the authentic voice of God actually is. That's what the fight's about. The Arab and Muslim hatred of Israel and the Jews can be understood, I would suggest, only if it's realized that Islam is a supersessionist religion, by which I mean it believes it must and should replace both Christianity and Judaism. It supersedes both of them. But of the two, it is Judaism to which it is in fact closest that it feels the greatest need to subjugate. Indeed, it's more than merely superseding it. Christianity wants to supersede Judaism. Christianity believes it grew out of Judaism and it replaces it. But it nevertheless acknowledges the biblical, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible as the basis for what came later. Islam, by contrast, does not merely want to replace the authority of Judaism by a later and superior model of Abrahamic monotheism. Islam seeks to obliterate Judaism altogether by appropriating its foundational story and doctrines, radically altering them, and claiming them to be authentic Judaism, while accusing the Jews of falsifying their own sacred text so as to disguise the alleged priority of Islam. Now, to conclude, not only does the West not see this at all, not only will it not speak about it, or think about it, or address it in any way, but Western progressives have also bought into the Muslim narrative of the Middle East, the projection of genocidal Islamic aggression onto its Israeli victims. You have the phenomenon, the extraordinary phenomenon, of Western progressives committed to gay rights, marching literally arm in arm with Islamists who would have homosexuals killed. Now, this alliance is partly explicable through kind of tactical, or do I mean strategic, considerations, the common aim to overturn the West. Partly it's explicable because Western progressives think we cannot possibly think that there's anything wrong with any minority or third world people. That's part of the reason. But I would suggest there is a deeper thing that binds them together. As I've tried to explain in my very brief remarks, Western progressives believe in a whole set of ideologies which are a form of secular millenarianism, utopianism, the perfection of the world, the perfection of life on earth, and from which there can be no dissent from the one revealed truth. And that is true also of Islam. And all have a common hostility towards Jewish religion or peoplehood. And this is perhaps the most extraordinary thing of all. When you look at Western secular ideologies of the kind that I've just talked about, scientism, man-made global warming, anti-Americanism, anti-Zionism, they all have at root a common hostility towards Jewish religion or peoplehood, fantastic as this may seem. The Greens believe, for example, that the root problem with the planet is Genesis, because Genesis gave man dominion over the earth, which they interpret as a kind of cultural species colonialism. Iraq War anti-Americanism, as we all know, is the fault of a conspiracy of Jews stretching from Washington to Jerusalem to subvert the foreign policy of America, put the world at risk. Even scientism, even Professor Dawkins, if you read his book, although his scorn for all religion knows no bounds, his greatest venom is reserved for the God of the Hebrew Bible, without whom apparently there would be no bigotry in the world, no intolerance, no war, no conflict. And as for moral and cultural relativism, these things basically at root are an assault on the fundamental doctrines of Western morality, which are in the Hebrew Bible, Ten Commandments and all that. And when you look at Western intellectuals, what binds them all is a, and I'm speaking generally, of course there are exceptions to all these things, but they basically have a view that reason and religion, or reason stroke science and religion, are in two completely separate compartments, and that they are inimical to each other. If you are a person of reason, when you spend your life devoted to the pursuit of rationality based on evidence, you can't be a religious believer because that is not rational. If you are a religious believer, it drives out science. Now, this is historically illiterate. There have been and still are many scientists who are religious believers, and they find no conflict between the two. But the problem with the Western intellectuals who make this distinction is their entirely false assumption that Western reason and science were created by secularism, that they were created by the Enlightenment, which overturned religion. That's a false view of the Enlightenment, in my view. But in my opinion, Western science grew out of the revolutionary claim in the Hebrew Bible that the universe was the product of a rational creator who endowed man with reason so that he could ask questions about the natural world as well as that rational creator. And that distinguishes the West from other cultures which did not have this belief in a rational universe, and where science, in my view, it was no coincidence that in all those other cultures, science ran into the sand. Only the West has developed science, modernity, democracy and freedom, and equality because it is based on those values and principles in the Hebrew Bible. Even though there are many secular people who don't believe, they basically rest their value system on those principles. Since biblical religion actually underpinned reason and morality, I would suggest the decline of religion has meant the erosion of truth, reason, and conscience. Objective truth has been replaced by subjective opinion and emotion across the board. There's been a much greater receptiveness to intellectual inversion, the replacement of truth by lies, much more credulity to propaganda. I would suggest we're living through an age of cultural totalitarianism. If religious totalitarianism was ruled by the medieval church, and political totalitarianism was ruled by the general will as expressed through communism and fascism, we are living through cultural totalitarianism, or rule by the subjective individual. It was Chesterton who said, when man stops believing in God, he'll believe in anything. I would suggest that these secular ideologies, which have replaced biblical religion, are subjecting truth to power and coercion. And my very final comment is this, that because the secular West is itself undermining and eroding the biblical foundations of both reason and liberty, it's therefore unable to stop Islam capitalizing on that weakness because it can't even recognize that is what's happening. The West, which prides itself on being the standard bearer of reason against Islamic obscurantism, is actually eroding its own ability to use reason at all. And so, by definition, does not understand what it is that it does not understand, including the danger that it faces. Thank you very much.
Melanie, thank you very much for what I promised would be a tour de force, and was. The floor is now open for questions. Maybe let me ask the first question. Are there any leaders, intellectual leaders of Islam who can counter the thrust of Islam that you portray?
Well, I don't know about leaders. It's hard to think of leaders, but there are certainly moderate Muslims, and that's a can of worms in itself to open up. You know, what is a moderate Muslim? But by my rather stringent definition of a moderate Muslim, there are moderate Muslims. There are many, many Muslims who don't even think about these things, who live in large quantities in Britain and elsewhere, and including in Islamic countries, I'm sure, who simply want to live like the rest of us. They want to live in peace and freedom. They want to be able just to live free of harassment, torture, imprisonment. They want to be able to bring up their children, have a job, have a reasonable standard of living, and make progress in life. That's what we all want. And they're no different. And there are many, many Muslims in Britain who think like that. And they are, to put it mildly, betrayed by two things. One is their own community leaders, who tend to be people who are politically minded and therefore tend to be extreme. And our leaders in Britain who appease them. And therefore betray and undermine those moderate Muslims. I personally believe that if people were courageous enough, and it does take a lot of courage for Muslims to stand up and say these things, and it takes courage for Western leaders to stand up and say these things, but if they were to stand up and say these things, they would help empower those Muslims, those many Muslims who do want to live in peace and freedom, and help resist what is currently the dominant force in the Islamic world.
Thank you very much, Melanie. As I call on you, why don't you just give your name and then ask your question, sir?
My name is Robert Weisberg. What you describe among many Muslims strikes me as almost a form of mental illness. I'm very reluctant to use that vocabulary in politics. But it does sound to me like many of them have difficulties dealing with reality. Difficulty understanding very basic terms. Now, first of all, do you think there is that element within the Islamic culture? And second of all, if it is there, the consequences of that are enormous, given the reluctance of Western societies to do this kind of therapy, which involves, in many cases, going in and changing families, changing schools. It's really beyond us to do this kind of, which I call group mental rehabilitation.
Well, like you, I would be very reluctant to use the term mental illness. Certainly, the difficulty dealing with the reality, but that is true of totalitarian ideologies. I mean, if you think back to Stalinism, there were many, many people. I mean, it was described brilliantly by countless brilliant writers. You know, Kafkaesque is now a term of, you know, we all use it. Orwellian. It's all the same thing. It's really precisely what I'm describing. It is a complete dislocation of reality and a kind of catch-22 situation where you can't see what you can't see and so on and so forth. When it comes to the Islamic world, you're dealing with something. I wouldn't describe it as mental illness. I would describe it more like, it's more helpful to think of it as a kind of cult, a kind of brainwashing cult. I mean, how do we deprogram people who are in a cult? I'm not an expert in dealing with that, but what has to happen as a prerequisite for getting on top of what's going on in that world is that we have to hold the line for our world, and we have to assert truth and reason. And we have to hold the line, we have to say, thus far and no further. And that's what we aren't doing, and that's what's, to me, so terrifying. Because terrifying as this phenomenon is, of all these people who are brainwashed, cult-affected, or whatever, however you want to describe it, we certainly can't deal with it if we ourselves can't think properly and clearly about all these things.
Yes, ma'am?
My name is Ruth King. I was wondering if you would comment on the fact that the only two moderate Muslim nations, Iran was one, their women were emancipated and educated, and now Turkey, there is this almost cult-like reversion to doctrinal Islam. And will we see that in Europe? Can we see that in the United States among the large Muslim population?
Well, this is precisely what I've, you know, been alluding to, that the sort of truly moderate Islam, by which I mean the desire to reconcile the sort of spiritual elements of the faith with the political imperative for freedom and rule of law and all that sort of stuff, the separation of mosque and state, if you like. That's being steadily eroded by this great Islamist tide, which is backed by the use of force. I mean, it's not to be downplayed. You know, if people show that they are the people who will blow you up unless you do what they want, then those people are going to win. Provided, if those people are going to win in circumstances where those who are under siege basically give up. And this is the point. It could be stopped, provided the free world changed its entire approach and stopped basically rewarding. What the free world has done for decades now is reward Islamist terror. It's refused to accept that it is Islamist terror. It's provided all kinds of alibis to do with, these are specific grievances to do with land, territory, ethnic fights. It's not. They've not understood or not been prepared to understand. This is a religious war. And consequently, it's been a catastrophic failure to engage on the terms that exist. The West believes that if it applies reason, it will win. The West believes that the Islamists are basically, wherever they are, they're all people who are governed by a sense of their own rational self-interest. And therefore, if we find in the West, we think, if we find ways of giving them at least part of what they want as part of their rational self-interest, if we try and remedy their grievances, for example, in the Middle East, their grievance is Palestine. So we'll remedy that grievance. We'll give them Palestine, and then it'll be so much better. It's the opposite is the case. The opposite is the case, because the West cannot understand what it's actually up against. So from the Muslim point of view, Muslim Arab point of view, a point of view which says there is force and there is weakness. I mean, people who apply rationality in the face of force are weak, and therefore we see our opportunity, and that redoubles our efforts. So there's this catastrophic misinterpretation, misunderstanding by the West. If it weren't to misunderstand, if it were to understand and hold the line, then I think that this great trend could be arrested. But at the moment, we are helping it along because all those states. I hesitate to use the word moderate, but sort of non-aggressive. Muslim states are all looking at where the strong horse is and where the weak horse is, and where the strong horse is where they will go. And if the strong horse is America, they'll go with America. If the strong horse is Iran and the weak horse is America, they'll go with Iran. And so it's not surprising that the Islamic Revolution is not stopped in Iran. What has America done to support the dissidents? I mean, you have these tremendous movements on the streets of Iran, of these fantastically brave people. You have people being hung from cranes every week or whatever it is for the crime of being dissident, homosexual, or whatever it is. The West says nothing. Nothing. We've done nothing to support them. So it's not surprising that the Islamic Revolution not only embeds itself even more in Iran, but rolls on through the region. Iran is behind Hezbollah. Iran is behind Hamas. What happens to it? The West gives more. It's completely mad. So this great tide that you're talking about, this sort of falling of the moderate Muslim dominoes in the world, is in large measure because the free world is basically enabling that to happen.
You can call.
Oh, okay. Sorry, this lady here.
Hi. During the last presidential election, neither of the candidates mentioned anything about Islamofascism being the biggest threat that this country and the world is facing. McCain didn't mention it, certainly not Obama. The only person who was mentioning it was Rudy Giuliani when he was running in primaries. Is this ever going to go? This is the biggest threat that's facing us, and it can't be discussed. There's something wrong. Can we ever go back?
Well, it's not being, I mean, I can tell you, it's not being discussed in Britain either. It's not exactly, it hasn't been mentioned at all. It's not discussed because our political leaders in the West are too frightened to discuss it in the terms that it must be discussed in. And they're even too frightened to discuss it in the terms that it is misleadingly being discussed in terms of regional conflicts. One awaits a leader, a true leader, in the West. I mean, this is what we, you know, it's a phenomenon. We don't have leaders, we have followers, we have frightened sheep. It's a fairly universal thing, although there are one or two exceptions, I would say, to that. Australia tends to throw up leaders who are much more robust. John Howard was one such. Harper in Canada is robust. But, you know, these people are kind of drowned out by the big guys. And the biggest guy is here. What's being done here is beyond catastrophic. Beyond catastrophic, the most mighty nation in the world, the nation which is the leader of the free world and the leading defender of the free world, has signaled from the start of the Obama presidency that America is offering its throat to its enemies. And that is beyond catastrophic. Now, you know better than I your system here. I mean, checks and balances. There are checks and balances, but what checks and balances there are to the president's ability to control foreign policy, I gather these are much more limited. Nevertheless, America is a robust democracy. The people can make their voices heard, and they should make their voices heard. People should be, you know, people should be aware of precisely, of not just how sort of stupid and catastrophic, but he is really exposing not just America, but the West, to the severest danger possible. And that should be said loudly all the time. Sir, the back.
Jennifer Abowitz, by the way, in November, it's not so far away, Obama's finished. And the Republicans take over the House. So there are some signs of life here. But in going to England, as the Labour Party sinks into the sunset, is there any good news of the two new who are rising, not new rising, but the two rising?
Well, as you may know, my reputation is that you can't distinguish me from a little ray of sunshine. Nevertheless, I have to break to you the sad news that no, there is no hope at the moment on the horizon for Britain. First of all, no one quite knows what's going to happen this coming Thursday when Britain goes to the polls. The situation is very volatile. The electorate basically is in the mood of, you know, we're going to vote for none of the above. And so when they get into the ballot, into the privacy of the ballot booth, heaven knows what they're finally going to decide. It may be that they finally decide that they can't stomach a weak government, and they will all vote for David Cameron on the basis that the Conservatives at least are, you know, would form a coherent administration rather than a hung parliament, which is what the polls are suggesting. At present, the polls are suggesting that no party will have the will get an overall majority, and so it could be that either Labour that the Conservatives will end up with the largest number of seats, or because our system is rather bizarre, because of our constituency system, the Conservatives could end up with the largest number of votes, but not the largest number of seats. It could even be that the Labour Party will end up with the largest number of seats, that neither Labour nor the Conservatives can nevertheless form a government without the Liberal Democrats. Now, the Liberal Democrats, no one's ever taken them seriously, and this is now proving to be a really quite catastrophic mistake. Because no one's ever really subjected their policies to a sufficient level of scrutiny. Everyone's basically assumed that they are a bunch of knitted yogurt sandal wearers, and consequently can be safely dismissed. But we're now going to have a knitted yogurt sandal wearer possibly being our foreign minister or something like that. The Liberal Democrats are serious bad news for civilization, I'm afraid to say. And if they are going to, as it were, hold the balance of power, this is not good news. Because the Conservatives have decided that the way back, they decided this some years ago when David Cameron became the leader of the Conservative Party, they decided the way back to power was by not being Conservatives. when David Cameron says, echoing Obama, who is his role model in all things, hope and change, what he's talking about is hope and change by changing from being conservative. And to be back in power, they have to be nice and cuddly and heart on sleeve and stop being the nasty party and be sympathetic and bleeding heart, and therefore they've got to be of the left. Who knows how David Cameron would behave if he became Prime Minister? No one's got the faintest idea. What people have understood is that what we've been given is a load of spin, which we just don't know what the real David Cameron would do. But so far, the auguries are not good. He has said that he would basically rethink the special relationship with America, that we would no longer be in Britain, we would no longer be in America's pocket. Thus playing to the gallery of popular opinion. Popular opinion in Britain is really, really hostile to American exceptionalism. It loves Obama because it thinks that Obama is very European and will destroy American power. And that's why Britain just loves Obama. So it doesn't like America at all, and it really doesn't like Israel. And by that, when I speak of that, I'm talking about the intelligentsia, I'm talking about the opinion formers, ordinary people. In Britain, because of the collapse of reason, the lower down the social and educational scale you go, the more sane and moral people are. But when it comes to the intelligentsia, the opinion formers, they're anti-Israel, they're anti-America, they're anti-West, they're anti-banker, they're anti-capitalism, they're pro-green, they're pro-lifestyle choice, and all of that. And the Conservative Party has decided to go with the flow to get them back into power. Whether it actually means that, as I said, I don't know. The Liberal Democrats certainly mean it. They certainly mean it, and more. The Labour Party doesn't mean anything in them anymore, and it will probably just sort of slink away and die, or possibly not, depending on whether it manages to hold on through our strange system. So that's a rather long way around of saying to you that things... I wouldn't rest your hopes in Britain for saving the West. Madam?
My name is Eve Kessner. Could you speak to what Israel... given the collapse of Western rationalism, what can they do to survive?
My views on what Israel should do don't go down very well in Israel, because I believe that in the utterly unsayable and entirely bizarre and revolutionary idea that Israel should tell the truth about its position in the world. I mean, Israel, I think, is the victim of... Israel has many problems, not least of which it's got a political system more fitted to a banana republic, which is a source of untold grief, to put it mildly. But it also, and not surprisingly, given the fact that it's endured nothing but aggression since its birth and is basically a sort of militarized society, it's highly dysfunctional, in my view, is suffering from a kind of collective Stockholm syndrome, in which it's kind of taken in the narrative of its oppressors to an extent which it doesn't actually realize it's doing. How else to explain the fact that here you have a situation where, as far as I know, it's unprecedented in the history of the globe, a country which, since its birth and before, but certainly since its birth, has been subjected to a constant militarized attempt to exterminate it, and is nevertheless told by the free world that it has to make compromises with and give at least part of the agenda of to the people who are continuing to aggress it, to threaten genocide and to fire rockets into it, and that because it is not doing so, it is the reason for the continuation of the impasse. Now, this is crazy. It is unprecedented. But Israel never says so. Why? Well, that's not how the world works. The world works according to realpolitik, The world works according to diplomatic conventions. The diplomatic convention is based on the idea that we all know what the solution to this will look like. We all know two nations for two peoples living side by side. We all want that. And Israel says, well, so that's what we're all working towards, because that is precisely what everybody wants. But what Israel should be saying is, this can't be the solution because this was the problem. We never had a problem with this. It was mooted back in the 1930s, and ever since then it has been rejected. So why are you putting pressure on us? In other words, there's a whole variety of ways in which, or the whole series of things from this central premise, which Israel could and should be saying, in my view. Instead, it colludes with the fiction. And consequently, it's locked into this process of madness, in which it is constantly being forced to and agreeing to appease its enemies, who take from this, see my remarks earlier about this whole business of, you know, who is the strong horse, who is the weak horse. Its enemies take from this, not surprisingly, the message that the more we push, the more they'll give us. And all we have to do is keep pushing, and then we'll get the lot. And Israel is locked into this. Instead, I mean, if Israel were to stand up at some, you know, very, very senior prime ministerial or very, very senior level and change the discourse of the world to truth, we'd have a very different situation. But it won't do that. In my view, this impasse, one has to understand, in my view, this impasse cannot be, in the Middle East, cannot be resolved until and unless the world actually tells the truth about what's caused it. The impasse has not been caused by the fact that this is one land divided between two people with equal claims. It's not being caused by the fact that it's all because of the Israeli intransigence over settlements and their biblical desire to hold on to Hebron and so on and so forth. It's being caused by one thing alone, that in the 1920s, when Arab violence was used to frustrate the expressed will of the international community for law and justice to settle the Jews in the land that was their ancient homeland, when the Arabs used force to stop that and to frustrate international law and justice, the British gave them a reward. And they've never stopped. And America and the EU has continued. That is the reason for the impasse. And until the world understands that, and behaves towards the aggressors in the Middle East in the way in which it used to behave towards aggressors anywhere, which is to say, the price of your aggression is you forfeit any claim you may have ever had, regardless of whether it was just. You forfeited it. It's over. Until and unless the West says that, we're going to get nowhere. But the West makes a complete exception when it comes to the Middle East. It suspends all its normal rules of law and justice, truth, everything, and applies a completely different template of denial of law, denial of justice, and blames Israel for those things. Now, if Israel doesn't actually say that, how can the rest of us say it? When the rest of us say it, people can turn around to people like me and say, you crazy? Israel's not saying this. Absolutely right. So I go to Israel and I say, Israel, why are you saying this? And they say, you crazy? This is the real world we're living in. And anyway, why do we have to justify our existence to these people? Britain, we all know what Britain did to us. Europe, the graveyard, forget it. We have America. We have America. And therefore, we're okay. But now they know. And now they know, tragically, tragically, now they can see. So, they have to start telling the truth.
Amen.
Sir.
Jenny, I subscribe to you and all of your views. But you mentioned about an ideological who forces facts to fit into theories. I was somewhat shocked that you're including atheists in the same camp as the militant Islams. I have never met a militant atheist. And all the atheists that I know, including myself, have no desire to convert others or to do violence to others for not being atheists. I mean, you may have a personal grudge with Dawkins, but I mean, I think if you read Dawkins and Harris and Hitchens, they're all completely subscribing to your views about Islam and Islamists. In other words, it's their very atheism that makes them most on your side about Islamic extremism. So why force them into the enemy camp?
Well, they're certainly anti-Islamist, and I suppose one could say, you know, my enemy is my friend, therefore we should be in alliance. But they are not our friends, they're not my friends, because they are not on side with various other issues that I've been talking about.
Well, there is a logic and evidence and reason. If they're, assuming that they're not the kind of people that you talk about who insist that their way is the only way, most atheists I know are, it's like a Dover case about the evolution. They're open to all kinds of.
Oh no, they're not. They're absolutely not open to all kinds of evidence. First of all, they say absurd things, really absurd things. And secondly, they treat people who oppose the view that scientific materialism accounts for everything in the universe as either imbeciles, mad, or evil. They are absolutely bigoted and intolerant towards any kind of dissent from their point of view, which is their point of view being that science alone accounts for everything in the universe.
I've never encountered that. I mean, in the founding fathers, I mean, all the atheists, like Thomas Paine and Jefferson, all those guys, they never.
Well, you should look perhaps at the fate that has befallen those scientists who have espoused what is called intelligent design. Mm-hmm. Now, here I am into very deep water, but intelligent design, to put it very, very simply, because I know we're running out of time very fast, intelligent design is demonized by that camp, the militant, what I would call the militant atheist camp, and confused, as in the Dover case, confused with creationism, deliberately as a smear. Now, some creationists may shelter behind intelligent design, but basically intelligent design, I make no claim for intelligent design, it's a theory. But it's a theory that comes out of science. That is to say, various people looked at the science, especially physics, and said, to put it very, very simply, the complexity of creation cannot be accounted for by chance. Basically, is what they were saying. Now, that is an argument which I can't have, but it seems to me a perfectly reasonable argument to have, which can be addressed in a reasonable fashion. But it's not addressed in a reasonable fashion by militant atheists who run these people out of town. They deprive them of their jobs. They subject them to character assassination. They call them creationists, which they are not. Creationists are people who believe the world was created in 6 days, literally, or if you're a young creationist, I believe in something like 2,000 or 6,000 years. But basically, it's crazy. Okay? So they accuse these people who are scientists of being creationists in order to blacken their reputations. And the great cases to do with ID and Darwinism in your school system here, the judges in those cases, particularly the one in Texas, Kansas, wherever it was, the judge could not understand the difference. He could not understand the difference.
But these are subtle issues.
They're not subtle. They're not subtle. They're not subtle at all. They're absolutely fundamental.
Most evolutionists I know are open to evidence, and that's what evolution is.
They are not open to evidence. Richard Lewontin, Harvard geneticist Richard Lewontin is the one of the few who's been honest about this. And he says, I paraphrase, he said something to the effect of, however absurd the assertions made under the rubric of science are, and some of them are ridiculous, we have to go with them because we cannot accept the possibility of a divine foot in the door. In other words, what he said, honestly and in terms, was that we, in this particular realm of scientism, this belief that materialism alone accounts for everything in the universe, we knowingly subscribe and promote ideas which are absolutely ludicrous because the alternative God is worse. I'll give you an anecdote. You say a personal beef. It is a personal beef with me and Richard Dawkins, but I think it's illuminating. I had a conversation with him in which he said, you know, I don't necessarily have a problem with the idea that there was an intelligence, governing intelligence, behind the creation of life on Earth. And I thought, my God, I've got a world scoop. But I didn't realize there was a comma. And after the comma, he said, provided that governing intelligence came here from another planet. And I said, what are you telling me, that you think little green men is more plausible as an explanation of the origin of life than God? And he said, there's no need to put it like that. I then went home and I did a bit of research, and I found that much as Professor Dawkins might have wished to lay claim to this exciting new theory, he didn't actually invent it. It was invented actually by a Swedish or a Danish physicist or somebody in the 18th century called Aron Hughes. We put him to one side. More contemporarily, it was given real traction by none other than Sir Francis Crick, the discoverer of DNA. Sir Francis Crick wrote a little book in which he explained his theory of directed panspermia. Directed panspermia is an argument which says the most plausible explanation of the origin of life on Earth is that it was seeded, S-E-E-D-E-D, on Earth by beings from another planet. He describes the spaceship in which these beings arrived, would have arrived, and it had to be constructed in a particular way for the particular time of being. In the course of this description, he writes, my wife has said to me that much of what I'm writing might be mistaken for science fiction. I can see her point. But the fact is that what I'm proposing is the least implausible explanation for the origin of everything. I rest my case.
Thank you. Thank you, Melanie, for a most stimulating presentation. And I think we all admire you, having heard you more than before having read you. And we commend you for living with truth and reason and courageously in a very difficult period of time. And I hope that your words get heard by more people in power.
Thank you very much.
To save us.
Thank you
very much.